Hi everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the M2.0 series of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Students Association's podcast. My name is Caitlin, and I will be your host for today's episode with special guest Dr. Bradley Frew. Brad is a wonderful GP practicing in Hastings, Victoria, who came to our podcast after being highly recommended by his students from the Monash University Peninsula Clinical School, who described him as an exceptional educator and a really nice bloke. As a GP, Brad has a special interest in veterans' health after serving as a medical officer in the Royal Australian Navy for several years before beginning his general practice. Brad was generous enough to sit down with me for an interview about his experiences with naval medicine. Our conversation is a little bit backwards in the sense that we started with the serious stuff before I threw a few curveballs, which were really well returned, I must say, and finally we ended on a high note with some icebreaker style questions to give you, our listeners, a good sense of Brad, the wonderful person that he is. Brad brings a new perspective to many issues and has a lot of great advice, which I think is beneficial not only for medical students but for everyone, and I hope that you agree. Before we start, I would like to give a language and trigger warning for this episode. Some listeners may find the content of this episode distressing. I would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we reside here in what is now known as Australia, where we are lucky to be recording from today. I extend my respects to the elders of all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, past, present, and emerging. AMSA acknowledges that sovereignty of this land has never been ceded, and this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
I'm only human, can you see? I made a mistake. Please just look me in my face. Tell me everything's okay. Cause I got it. Ooh, never be like you.
Hi, my name's Bradley Frew. I'm a GP down in Hastings, Victoria, and I'm also one of the academic staff at Monash University Peninsula Clinical School, where I work as a lecturer coordinating the GP program. And I'm also an ex-Navy military medical officer, Australian Navy for a few years, and now I kind of specialise in veterans' health and veterans down in the Western Port community.
Thanks, Brad. Can you tell us, how did you end up in naval medicine and what's brought you to where you are now?
So like all medical students of my year, I think none of us really knew what we wanted to do. It's different now. I feel like medical students now have to choose their career path in week one of medicine so that you can line up your 15 PhDs that are required to get on said training program. But back when I was a student, you know, definitely had a little bit more flexibility and tried to be as open-minded as I could be. And then about halfway through my degree, I heard about one of the military scholarships. So, you know, it sounded ideal. I've always kind of been interested in the military. My grandfather, on the other side, he was actually the Surgeon General for the Australian Navy. So a bit of a proud naval history. And I thought, well, this sounds like a great idea. You know, I'll pay through my degree, a bit of exposure in military medicine. And the career path at that point, and still is today, if you are going to be a full-time kind of medical officer for the military, then what goes in specialty is general practice. There is opportunity to be a specialist, but that's only in reserve work. So there's very few full-time reserve specialists in the military. So that kind of dictated my path into general practice. But it was always a career that I was interested in. You know, I'm a bit fickle. I get bored easily. So I need to have stuff at me. I couldn't stand dealing with AF every day. Like, it would drive me crazy. So it was a good fit for me in that and a bit of adventure. So that's kind of led me to joining the military, doing my stint Navy service. And then after I left the Navy, kind of really, I guess, there was a lot of experiences, which we'll probably talk a little bit about later, that kind of changed who I am as a person, as well as changed my views on military health. I'd be interested in helping support veterans as they transition out of services. And unfortunately, government's trying to do a better job at helping veterans transition out of the services, but there's still a long way to go. And there's a lot of struggling veterans out there. So it's a natural fit for me, really, to fall into that area and fill that niche, which has been great. It's really rewarding work, but certainly challenging.
For those of us who don't know as much as we should about naval medicine, Can you tell us what it's like being a naval doctor and what are the common conditions that you see or treat?
It largely depends on where you work. So if you're at sea, it was very different to if you're ashore, for example. Generally, the work on base ashore was normal general practice. You know, you would have a lot of musculoskeletal medicine, you know, doing pack marches and runs and that sort of stuff, getting sports injuries. So you expect those sort of things, as well as, you know, you have older chief petty officers and commanders and things like that with the spectrum of chronic disease, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, you know, managing those sort of problems. A lot of bureaucracy, a lot of paperwork. Every form had to be filled out 100 times and lots of medicals and examinations and doing assessments and writing copious amounts of paperwork. When you're at sea, the way I describe it to people is 50-60% training. So it's a lot of training up your ship's crew to manage emergencies. You know, ship's been torpedoed. This person's drowning. This person's got their arm blown off. How do you manage that? So a lot of training work. Then there'd be 30% general practice. And in some respects, unfortunately, there is the old adage of sailors in foreign ports sometimes run through. So there was a bit of sexual health work that was part of that. Then there'd be about 10% sheer terror. So those are, you're in sea state 10. So 10 meter swells, ship is rocking up and down like crazy. Person falls down the ladder bay, GCS of 3, you know, potential brain injury. No one else to help you apart from a medic who has limited training and experience. Phones are down, really put you on the spot. Or it could be managing an open fracture from someone who's fallen down a ladder bay. But particularly, I think the most challenging medical scenarios came about when I was doing Operation Resolute, which is our kind of border patrol things and managing the refugees. So it was a hard job kind of emotionally because politically I didn't agree with what the government was doing, the instrument of the government, and you have no choice in that. And managing really critically ill kind of refugees and being told you're not allowed to medevac them and things like that was, so those were anything from difficult labours, you know, people going to labour on a refugee boat, people self-harming, burning themselves. So a real spectrum of stuff, I guess. A lot of training, a lot of general practice-y coughs and colds, sports injuries, and then, you know, some really challenging scenarios as well.
Wow, that sounds like a lot scarier and a lot more interesting experience than I was expecting. How did you go with such a broad scope of things? So from training to managing burns and people in horrific situations?
So it really does become a induction of fire. So how well can you prepare yourself for that sort of situation? You know, you just have to talk to doctors that have done, you know, medicine sans frontières. You know, they'll tell you about, it's just the next level. And I don't think you can ever really prepare yourself for it. You really just have to throw yourself in and give it a go. And emotionally, I think you deal with it by talking to your crew, talking to your friends, debriefing about it. And this is, I guess, where I have one of the biggest problems with the way the military is run at the moment, is there is still a very much an attitude of just suck it up. We clearly know it doesn't work. And I can point you to the hundreds of veterans that I look after that are very broken that will tell you that that strategy doesn't work. So I think I took it upon myself to be proactive about it and definitely seek help. And when I was back ashore and things, to help process some of those traumas and go through it all. But it's something that we need to work on a lot more in the military currently. And I think if any of the people listening to this are interested in military careers, it is something to be aware of, that part of being in the military is going to be being exposed to trauma. And I think it's good to go in with that mindset, that to try and be prepared as much as you can, because unfortunately the military probably won't prepare you all that well for it.
Thanks, Brad. That makes a lot of sense. Do you think that your experiences have made it easier for your role working with veterans and returned service people? Do you think that we could teach more about veteran health in medical school to help us to deal with similar situations in the future?
So definitely for what I'm doing now, you know, I have veterans that come from all over the state to come and see me. So I have, because there's a limited amount of, I guess, doctors with a skill set in navigating DVA and doing all the sort of veterans health stuff that's very specific and nuanced, as well as with the telehealth. As soon as my patient moved interstate, found out about it, I've been managing them again. So I've got patients. Spoke to patients in Northern Territory, Queensland and WA yesterday that were veterans of mine that have moved along. So definitely, and I think part of the reason I seek that out is that shared experience. You know, I've been through the trauma, I've been through the processes, I understand it. And I don't necessarily think it's something of military medicine in particular that needs to be taught in medical school because it is such a very nuanced subspecialty. I'm sure you've interviewed many or spoken to many a specialist that is the master of IgA nephropathy who will say to you, you must know everything about IgA nephropathy. It is the be-all and end-all of medicine. Who cares about anything else? You know, we should have 6 years devoted to IgA nephropathy. But that's certainly not my view. I think we need to be holistic as well. But I think the skills that I think need to be taught more, particularly when it comes to mental health in medical school, you know, you do a psychiatry rotation, you know, you get 9 weeks of exposure to public psychiatry, which is a lot of crisis containment, and you don't actually get any exposure to dealing with complex trauma and dealing with complex depression or things in a longitudinal way, which is really the only way to experience it. I wish we could gear our system a little bit better to do that. And I think the way to do that would be to have a more longitudinal medical program where you get to follow patients along in their journeys and do that. But it's hard because it's a compacted curriculum. Everyone wants their slice of the pie. And I think I wish that I hope medical students seek more advice about is particularly about dealing with people with trauma. I think it's an important skill to have because regardless of what specialty you choose as a surgeon, if you have a patient with severe PTSD, they're going to be challenging to manage on the wards. They're going to be challenging to manage perioperatively. It's going to have implications in so many different areas of medicine. So I think it's good to have an understanding of that as well.
For our medical students listening, is there one way, better than others, in your opinion, for us to learn about complex trauma? For example, is approaching our psych rotations with an open mind enough, or do you think that there's any electives or similar experiences that students could do to prepare?
Look, I guess the thing for medical students is it's hard to pick where you need to prioritise and do things because your time is short and there's things as well. So I think when it comes to making the most of every opportunity, I think it's good to go into every rotation with an open mind, regardless of what you're interested in. Even if you've been day one, I'm going to be a neurosurgeon, I want you, and I say this to the students that come and see me at PCS as well, I don't care if you don't want to be a GP. You know, if you don't want to be a GP, I don't want you to be a GP. But what I expect is that you approach it with an open mind and you take every learning opportunity that comes at you and you explore those and you run with them as well. And even if you are convinced about where your path is going to take you, you think about your current rotation or your current learning as how it can help you in the future. I think the best ways to learn about complex mental illness is to go into the psych rotation and be really proactive about it and try and ask lots of questions of your mentors and your teachers and talk to patients as well. You know, take the time to get to know them. You know, yes, they're hard patients to get to know. They're complex. They're really unwell usually if they're in hospital, but hopefully you're getting exposures in community well and in your general practices. You know, you will find that every GP does a lot of mental health. You know, it's a huge part of our work, regardless of your subspecialty or your interest area. I think the Beach study shows it makes up like 20% of our work or something. It's quite a large proportion of it. So, you know, asking questions is how do you manage this? How would you do this? And then we know that good mentors make a big difference to one of your experiences in medical school. So seek them out and spend time with them as well.
Just before you mentioned the importance of mentors, have you had any good mentors or mentors that have guided you to where you are today?
So early on in my medical career, like intern residency, I think some of my best mentors were actually the bad mentors where you learn the stuff that you don't want to be. And I think that's just as valuable, I've got to say. It's hard when you're in it, you know, when you've got a, you know, I was doing a gen surg rotation and I won't name names. And our retired surgeon was notorious for having like temper tantrums, throwing instruments in the theatre. Refuse to learn the interns' names. We just call you intern one, intern two, and intern three. You know, those sort of experiences when you're in them, you know, they're hard to stomach, but they actually do really kind of help you about it. And well, when I saw your email with the different questions that you might ask, one of the things was, what's a quote that you live by, or something along those sort of lines. And there's an author, I can't remember the name, which was, bad decisions make the best stories. And I think that's a good kind of quote because I often think about those experiences that I had. But out of the positive mentors, you know, like I had a privilege of working for a number of years with John Murtagh, godfather of general practice, absolute guru. And I think the things that I took out of him is his like unrelenting questioning nature. He's always adapting general practice. So just the way he thinks in terms of reasoning is just to a next level that I really aspire to. You know, his base level of knowledge to be able to see a condition, to think about different ways of red flags, pitfalls, and I think that was really kind of inspirational for me, and I try to emulate that as much as possible. But I had some good military mentors as well. You know, there was a really good lieutenant commander that was at the submarine and underwater medicine unit that I got on really well with, who gave me lots of really good pragmatic advice about, you know, dealing with Navy command. And I think the best advice he gave me, which helped me get through my military career, was just let it be, but yeah, it's hard when you see systemic failures and you see systems that are just fundamentally broken. Like, why on earth are we doing this? This makes no sense. Let it be, bro. Let it be.
Beyond your mentors, is there any good advice that you've received or any good advice that you could share with us?
So if I was to look back at young, much more attractive Brad, I think I would advise myself to just be more confident, I think, is where it is. Like, I'm now, look, it obviously comes with age. We all know that as you evolve, you know, your values change and your systems and things like that. But I think I was underconfident as a junior doctor. And I'm not talking about confidence in the terms of medical ability or things like that. I'm just talking about confidence within yourself and believing in yourself that I am making the right choice and that things will be okay. So, and I guess I see that through the flip side of my journey to where I am now. Some mindfulness principles, which was, you know, when I had my own journey with PTSD, mindfulness was a really kind of powerful tool for me that I used quite a lot to help manage that. And one of the principles, the seven principles of mindfulness, is one of them is trust, which is trusting in yourself and trusting that things will work out as well. I think we get caught up in the day-to-day. We get caught up in, you know, I need to get this done, I need to get this done. Some of my friends say I take mindfulness to a probably an extreme level, that I'm so mindful I'm almost comatose. I channel my inner Craig Cassidy, who often is so mindful in a meeting that you wonder whether he's asleep and then realize he actually is asleep. But I try not to do that, but definitely think I would encourage myself as a junior doctor to be more mindful, more confident in myself, trust in myself more.
Earlier you alluded to experiences during your time with the Navy that changed your perspective and who you are as a person. Fitting with our new perspectives theme, would you mind elaborating on this a little and sharing some of your story?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think definitely as a junior doctor and also just being young and being in the military, a bit of bravado, you know, all that sort of stuff, you don't think of yourself as ever necessarily having problems or having mental health issues developing. And definitely when I was doing the Operation Resolute work, I had a refugee try and take me hostage with a knife. And then the refugee ended up trying to kill themselves with that knife. They slashed open their abdomen. So, you know, there was bowel coming out and it was pretty horrific. It was not a great scenario. And I was pretty much left high and dry by, you know, military command and things a little bit. So there was, I guess I didn't really want to admit to myself there was a problem there. You know, I proceeded on my next deployment, you know, not really managing it very well, but, you know, waking up with nightmares of the scenario. And eventually, you know, I think I did seek help. I went and saw one of the other doctors on base and finally linked in with a psychologist and, you know, diagnosed PTSD and started my own journey towards that. And I think as, you know, I developed the skills of, you know, mindfulness and things to help manage that and going through processing the trauma and things, it certainly changes your perspective, particularly about mental health. And I think it happens to a lot of us, you know, it won't happen to me, it won't happen to me. But the statistics tell us otherwise. You know, one in three people experience depression, anxiety, mental health problems at some point in their lives. And the things that it's really brought about for me in terms of my perspective is, I guess, you know, it's changed the way that I relate to patients. And I think that's the feedback that I get a lot from my patients. And I have trauma patients that are non-military as well that come and see me. That shared experience, and they can see, sympathize with kind of what they've been through and just understand that. That being said, you know, you don't have to go through a horrific trauma to actually, and I wouldn't recommend that to anyone, to develop a new perspective or a new understanding. But as I heard the stories of patients, and I think, you know, maybe as a junior doctor, time-focused, task-focused, I'm going to do this. But actually when I stopped to listen to the patient's stories and actually really engage with them, that's when you develop a new perspective on the patients and they develop a new perspective on you. And that's when the doctor-patient relationship really grows and becomes something quite beautiful. There's a few different schools of thought in medicine about how much you should share of your own personal journeys with patients. You know, a lot of doctors are very private and it's a very business-like relationship. You come in, it's transactional, and then you're out. And that works for some people, and that's just personality type driven, you know, depends on who you are. But the way that I'm geared as my personality type is, you know, I think I like to engage with people. I like to see their worldview. I like to understand who they are as a person, not just their illness. And I think as I develop that perspective, it just changed who I am as a doctor and also who I am as a person as well. You know, I think about it as a father. I've got a 3.5-year-old and a 4-month-old now. And it's changed the way that, you know, I parent, I think, as well. Obviously, I didn't parent before I had trauma, but I try and develop that emotional connection in my daughter. It's hard with a 4-month-old. They don't have a lot of emotional maturity. It's a lot about pooing and weeing and eating, really. But my 3.5-year-old definitely trying to get her to develop an emotional intelligence as well.
Thanks, Brad, for sharing that with us. You mentioned that a lot of people believe that they're immune to mental illness and that stigma remains such a big issue where people are not willing or not able to recognize when they're experiencing poor mental health. Is there any advice that you'd give to these people?
Yeah, definitely. So look, when it comes to seeking help, I think fear of stigma is a real problem, particularly within medical circles, unfortunately, depending on where you're working, what sort of field you're working in and who surrounds you as people. A psychologist once told me that one of the Alcoholic Anonymous mantras is what other people think of me is none of my business. So, and I think that is a very useful path to acknowledge. So stigma is all about what other people think of you, and it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't. Who cares what other people think of you? If they don't like who you are as a person because you tell them you've got mental health problems, then they've got their own set of problems, and then it doesn't matter. But it's hard when you're in the midst of it because you do fear that. But on the flip side of that, you know, every friend I ever talk to about my problems, every family member that I ever talk to about my problems, I've received nothing but support. And I think we are much more attuned these days to mental health. And I think as doctors, we're much more attuned to it with our colleagues. And I think everyone out there will have your back. So please talk to people if you're struggling. There's absolutely no reason to think that you'll be judged negatively, that it'll impact your career. The thing that will impact your career will be if you don't seek help, because that's when you can just end up in a deep, dark hole, hard to get out.
Wow. I think that's really good advice. I really like that. So just to change things up a little bit now, jumping back, can you describe for us what a normal day is like for you? So even though nothing's really very normal at the moment, what was a normal day like for you in the Navy and what's it like now for you as a GP?
An average day in the Navy for me ashore would have been, day starts at roughly sort of 6:30 for what they call sick parade, which was people who had become sick or unwell overnight would present first thing in the morning. They'd be assessed by a medic, their illness, and then you would spend the first part of your morning consulting with the people's illnesses overnight, coming up with management plans. You know, often be colds, flus, too much alcohol, too much sex. Those sort of issues would arise. And then the rest of your day would be geared around often doing health assessments, because I was one of the things they trained me up in the military was underwater medicine, doing assessments on people for diving. So because of that, I did a lot of work with clearance divers, which is like the Navy's version of special forces, assessments on them, doing annual medicals, and then routine appointments for follow-ups of, you know, chronic diseases, much like general practice. So day would finish roughly at about 3:30, 4 o'clock, you know, if you started early, and then you got a half day on Fridays, which was nice. Finish at 1 o'clock on Fridays, and there was very little weekend work apart from if there was an emergency or something. But most of the time, they called ambulances really for an emergency. Whereas I guess day to day for me now, you know, I work 3 days a week as a GP, a day a week for Monash University, and I also kind of have a casual role where I do supervision of the military registrars in general practice. So I'll go out and visit them in practice and watch them doing consultations, give them feedback about their consultation style, their management, their clinical skills. So, but my average clinic day is, you know, sort of 8:30 to 5:30. I have predominantly long appointments because my patients are complex. So, and, you know, doing a lot of mental health and counselling support. So I've done extra training in counselling and mental health skills. I do focused psychological strategies with them, CBT, mindfulness, things like that. And interspersed with that is normal general practice. You know, I do still like to see snotty kids. Well, not at the moment, I don't want to see snotty kids, not without a whole heap of plastic on my face. But, you know, I do still like looking after a pregnancy or seeing a patient with a laceration or a skin lesion. And so I still try and mix that into it as well. But yeah, from a day-to-day perspective, I think military medicine is not that dissimilar to general practice, which is why they want GPs.
You mentioned registrars in the Navy earlier. What's the training program like? Is it something that you can go into after medical school or internship, or do you need to do GP training or something similar first?
The training program, if you take the undergraduate scholarship, for me, I was still part of the 6-year medical curriculum. So I took the scholarship in year 4. So I had a scholarship for 2.5 years. So that meant I had to give the military 3.5 years back on completion. As a student, you know, I had very minimal military commitments. I had an emotional unit based in the city for people doing civilian studies. And then I'd check in with them once a month or so. And then intern and resident years were done as normal. So I did those at Monash Health. And then I went in to do 6 months of basic officer training, which was completely non-medical. So that was yes, sir, no, sir, 3 bags full, sir. You get to do some fun stuff like blow stuff up if that rocks your boat, fire guns and drive around in boats fast and kind of fun, wear a cool uniform. And then after that, I was pretty much on deployment. So I was went from ships to shore, ships to shore. The way the training program works now is you actually do 3 years after you finish medical school, and you do, in that third year, you do a full year of general practice, and that is a much better idea. Because a year of general practice gives you a huge amount more skills, which I would have loved. I found the skills, but I learned them the hard way. In the military now, they do this third year, which I think is a much better idea. So the other pathway in which you could, you know, be involved in the military if it's something that people are interested in is through reserves. So you can complete your specialty training and then sign on in what they call the specialist reserve. And the only time you're really activated is if there's a major emergency, like bushfires. I activated some of the reservists for that and put them on HMAS Adelaide, which was floating off the coast of Eden. And then they activated in time of war. You know, like I said, they deploy surgeons over to Afghanistan. You know, so if you're interested in doing specialty training but also interested in the military, that's probably the path to go down. You can also be in the reserves as a junior doctor. Capacities are kind of a little bit limited. They prefer to wait till you're in specialist reserve.
Thanks, Brad. So you mentioned spending some time on land and at sea. Did you ever spend long periods of time at sea? And if you did, how did you deal with cabin fever and keeping morale up when you had so many people on board?
So doctors were kind of in a strange situation in the Navy in that you're not often permanently posted to a crew. They only ever have a doctor on board a ship when it's on deployment overseas. So when they're doing operations within Australia, apart from the border patrol thing, when they're just cruising up and down around Sydney Harbour and things, they don't have a doctor on board, which did make it challenging at times because you kind of get flown in just before a deployment starts, and then it makes it hard to, you know, build up a rapport with the crew and things. But normally spend, you know, 2 to 3 months on a deployment at a time. So, and there are some great experiences that you have, stuff that you just can't do anywhere else. Like probably my favourite deployment that I had was with HMAS Melbourne, which is one of our fighter missile frigates. And we were going over to Hawaii to test a new missile system that had been installed on the ship. And so one, you know, getting to go to a tropical location, which was pretty cool. The crew on there were just really, really good fun. Had an amazing captain on board the ship. So she was really supportive and proactive. And that was probably my favourite deployment. And one of my favourite memories of that was we were cruising in the Pacific Ocean, and it was a dead calm, still day. Like, the water literally looked like it was not a single ripple on it. And the, I was, I don't know, probably about 28, 30 degrees, and the captain has just said, okay, stop the boat, we're going for a swim. So to swimming exercise, we'll jump off the back of the hangar deck, and I'm looking in the water and I'm kind of like, oh, geez, it's really dark and murky, that's strange. And then I realize as I look underwater, actually the visibility is out to hundreds of meters. It's just because there was 3.5 kilometers of water below us. And you realize you just would never have that experience anywhere else. You know, swimming in a crystal clear ocean on a beautiful day with no wind, nothing, in the middle of nowhere with 3.5 kilometers of water below you. And then that same night, you know, the captain was like, okay, we'll do a steel deck barbecue, which is and when the officers will cook a barbecue for the rest of the crew. And then you put a movie on a hangar sheet on the back of the hangar and project a movie onto there. And you know, those are just, you don't get those experiences elsewhere. Sorry, I think I sidetracked there.
No, that's absolutely perfect. I fully support getting sidetracked, especially when it's for such a nice story. Were you ever scared of sharks or anything like this? Was that something that you trained for?
So when you're doing a swimming exercise, they have a gunner of the watch. So they have someone with a rifle up on the bridge wing who, look, a bullet, once it enters the water, is useless after it gets about 10 to 20 centimetres. So if a shark had decided to take us, you know, the gunner of the watch would, I think I said to the gunner of the watch one day, I said, look, if a shark gets me, just shoot me rather than the shark, because it's probably going to be more effective, really. But I think it's there for psychological reasons, to make us feel better that if the shark came and got us. But on the flip side, you could see the shark. It was good visibility. If you have a chance to outrun it, you probably wouldn't. But the shark had never really been a problem in any of the diving operations. There's only ever been one clearance diver who's been attacked by a shark. He was attacked in Sydney Harbour, I think in 2008, 2009. So there's only ever, considering the amount of diving operations and things that we do, very few shark attacks. I think surfing's more dangerous. I tell that one of the psychologists I work with is a mad surfer, and he's out there at like dawn surfing. You're crazy. You get eaten by a shark one of these days. He's a really good psychologist. One of his other mantras that he gave me, which I find really helpful, which is he says to patients, if you're not in the moment, not living in the moment, you're not living in reality. If you're thinking about the future, you're thinking about the past, you're thinking in your version of reality. It's actually not reality. I love that. I think that's a great way. Sorry, again, sidetracked. Now you know what it's like for my students. I get this way.
I think sometimes it's good to be sidetracked. My next question is, when you've had such good and bad experiences at sea, did you ever have trouble coming back, you know, getting your land legs or settling back into society?
I think the biggest problem of coming back after a prolonged deployment is actually reintegrating into a bit of civilian life, is your day is very regimented at sea. Like, I'd be in a small bedroom, would have six people stacked on top of it. You know, it's like it's, you're right on top of people all the time. There's no such thing as privacy. The amount of times I often take the middle bunk, open my curtain in the morning just to have a naked man right in front of me every morning. So when I'd come back ashore, I purposely lived alone because you just wanted isolation. And one of the funny things that's come out of the coronavirus thing with my veteran patients, and I think almost all of them have said it to me, I say, how are you managing with the coronavirus restrictions and isolation? And they're like, oh, the military trained us for this for years. I've been living in isolation before it was cool to do so. So, because when you're just on top of people all the time, you really just crave personal space more than anything else. And a long hot shower. You're limited to like 60-second showers. And they're often cold.
Nope, that does not sound like fun at all. Now, this may or may not be something that you've experienced, but do you have any tips or any miracle cures for seasickness for those of us that get a bit queasy on the water?
So it's always a trade-off between effectiveness and sedation. The more sedating, the more effective it seems to be. But when you're in the Navy, you know, really want to give a sailor who's seasick a really sedating antihistamine and then say, yeah, go and operate the 5-inch gun. That's a good idea. So our first line was always hyoscine boride. That's just the standard because it's not sedating. But, you know, you do get those dry mouth anticholinergic effects from it. And most people kind of find that effective. And then I'd usually use one of the other antihistamines, Avil or Osef, if it wasn't really working. Our last line was injecting Phenergan for people. I had a number of people that joined the Navy, and I said to them, they'd come to the sick bay being really, really seasick. And I'd say, you know, why did you join the Navy if you get seasick? And they're like, oh, I thought I'd kind of work it out of me or something. I'm like, it doesn't really work that way. I guess you, over time, you do learn to adapt in some respect to it. But you know, in the end, a fair chunk of them had to be taken off the ship or end up on shore postings. It's become effectively useless because they'd be sedated on antihistamines to stop them vomiting everywhere. Acupressure is also good, using the little acupressure point things that go on your wrist. They're quite good too. Lots of water. And look at the horizon. It was bad for us because often the Navy ship is, you know, you don't have portholes and stuff, you know, from the depths of the ship. You can't look out on the horizon. So a lot of the cruise ships, unfortunately, don't have a lookout outside either. I don't think anyone's going to be going on a cruise anytime soon after the Ruby Princess. I think it's tainted most people's view recently. I was never going to go back. One of my patients told me a story when they went on a cruise and a bout of norovirus went through the ship. So quarantine authorities actually kept the ship moored at Sydney Harbour because they didn't want the norovirus running rampant in the community. And the sewer system got overloaded and there was actually poo running down the walls of the cabins. After my patient told me that, I'm like, nah. I spent enough time at sea in the Navy and I need to do cruises as well.
Yes. I think that's enough to put just about anyone off. I think I'll be staying on land for some time too after that story. So just while I gather my thoughts a bit, do you have a philosophy or mantra that you live by that you could share with us?
Now, I read a quote which was by Ricky Gervais, which is, being nice is far more important than being clever. And it just reminded me of a conversation I had with one of our students in practice just recently. So obviously I've had lots of students in practice over the years and varies a little bit in terms of confidence. And in particular, this student, you know, has an absolutely brilliant manner. So she's really compassionate, really empathetic, really engaging with patients, really seeking feedback, really seeking acknowledgement from patients and things as well, following up on patient cues. And I'd often ask her questions, you know, throughout the day, what antibiotic would you use for this? What treatment would you use for this? And she may not know the answer, which is completely fine. That's part of learning. But would often become a bit despondent about it. And I was doing her feedback just recently. And as I said to her, I much, much prefer to see in students and junior doctors emotional intelligence and compassion than knowing about the 53 different causes of, say, IgA nephropathy. Don't think of anything else. So everything, the way we are in modern medicine now is it is so quick to look stuff up. And most junior doctors now are excellent at navigating various resources, looking at, you know, latest treatment guidelines, et cetera, which is why I find it just so archaic that our OSCEs and written exams aren't open book, because nothing you do in medicine is ever closed book. You know, we're always teaching you that you should look stuff up. And then, yep, when we get your exams, you're told, no, you're not allowed to look stuff up. And it's completely contradictory. So I said to her, I much, much prefer to see the emotional intelligence that you're displaying, the compassion that you're displaying, because those are the things that make a great doctor. Doctors don't get sued for mistakes. You know? Doctors get sued for poor communication around their mistakes. You're always going to, doesn't matter how brilliant you are, at some point in your career, you are going to stuff up and there's going to be an adverse outcome for a patient. And the way that you handle that, the way that you speak to the patient, communicate with them, will largely determine the outcome. And I said to this student, the way that you are as a person, as a doctor, is going to put you in far better stead than the person who may have the Z score of 1, because that doesn't make them a good doctor. So, yeah, being nice, much more important than being clever.
That's a really good mantra. I really like that. So backtracking now, keeping with our new perspectives theme, has there ever been a time that you found was really rewarding and that really reassured you that this is where you're supposed to be?
I guess that you celebrate the little victories in medicine. General practice is never a career, I guess, where you get those, you do get those save your life moments, but I guess they're fewer and further between. You know, you often see people getting on the media about, you know, oh, Professor Meredith, you know, put a stent in when my heart was terrible and saved my life. What a miracle worker. And see that you don't get those because we're preventative health specialists in general practice. And no one ever gets on the media going, Dr. Fru saved my life by managing my blood pressure and cholesterol brilliantly. You know, what a hero. But I think where the moments I get where I know I'm doing the right job. So I've had a patient fly back from London to see me because she couldn't get good health care over there. So it's like, I just needed to see you, Brad. Like, so I was like, oh, clearly I'm doing my job all right then if I fly back from London. That's nice to know. And I actually had a patient say to me the other week, I just called her up because I hadn't seen her in a few weeks. And she's normally someone who would come and see me every 1 to 2 weeks. No, I just thought, oh, that's a bit unusual for her to not come. So I might just give her a call and see what's happening. She kind of said to me, if it wasn't for you, Brad, I probably wouldn't be alive. This phone call has actually meant more to me than you would ever even realize. And it just shows that you are interested in me and know me and that you actually wanted to call and find out how I was going. It means more than you can ever understand. And you know, those are the moments, I think, that are really reaffirming. There are moments where it's frustrating, and I wouldn't say I ever find the medicine frustrating. Sure, there are challenging patients, you know, they're drug seekers or there's aggressive patients and things like that you come across. But I actually, you know, it's just a matter of knowing where they're coming from and trying to, you know, and I have a patient who can get aggressive at times. You know, I said to him one day, I'll change his name, so Bob. So Bob, you know, you often get worked up when you're coming to see me. Do you want to change doctors? Do you want to see someone different? And he's like, excuse the French, he was like, no, fuck it, mate, doc. I fucking like you. It's okay. And I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, that was, I guess, another moment where I guess you, but yeah, where the frustrations I get live, it's actually more system-based than anything else. The patient who has to wait 18 to 24 months to get their hip or knee replacement because the public waiting lists are abysmal. You know, the patient who can't see an ophthalmologist because they charge $500 to go and have a sit down with them. I guess I'm letting my political views kind of come out. I'm a bit of a socialist. So it frustrates me when healthcare inequities are created by a system. So those are the moments that I get frustrated, but I think I would be more frustrated in a public health system in terms of working for the hospital where it's about pushing throughput, and at least I can manage my role as a doctor without anyone telling me how to do it, apart from the government who tells me how they fund me for doing it. So half the stuff we do is for free because they choose not to fund us for it. So for the love of it.
Putting you on the spot here, sorry, Brad. If you could change one thing about the health system that would help a lot of people that you see and people in the community, is there one thing that you could think of that could be changed in the system to help our system to change for the better?
So controversially, I think we should entirely scrap the private health system. And I think it should be a properly funded public health system. So the money that goes into private health could go into properly funding a public health system. Where I get frustrated is in private system, you get a lot of over-servicing. So patients that probably really only need a day or two end up having 5 to 6 days because there's plenty of beds, and especially it's kind of like, no, you don't really need an angiogram. Oh, hang on a second. You've got private health insurance. Yes, we'll book you in for an angiogram tomorrow. Those sort of things that creates a perverse incentive in healthcare. It's not outcomes focused. It's not, it just doesn't work. So I think the fundamental system change, which will never happen, is that we, you know, probably need to increase the Medicare levy to fund it properly, and then scrap the private health system, get everyone treated equitably in our system. Just because you have money doesn't mean that your healthcare outcome should be better than someone who doesn't. And while we still have a two-tiered system, we're never going to have health equity in this country. And all you have to have a look at is the state of Indigenous health in this country to know that health inequity is a major, major problem. It's going to take a very brave government to do that because it means fundamental shift in the way medicine is done. And the AMA, who are predominantly an organisation that represents specialists, will be fundamentally opposed to that and will campaign vehemently to stop that from happening.
Thanks for sharing your views. That was really interesting. This is definitely an easier question. If you were a private specialist for some reason, what sort of car would you buy?
Ooh. Am I earning ophthalmology money or am I earning just kind of renal physician money?
No, the big bucks.
The big bucks. I reckon the Range Rover Vogue, like the top of the line autobiography. You can tell I'm a family man because we have a Subaru Outback. I'm all about space for the kids. So, you know, a lot of people would probably be like, oh, I'll drive the Ferrari. I'm like, you can't put a 3.5-year-old in a Ferrari. I'm not going to fit in that. So the ultra luxury SUV would be it for me.
So doing things a little bit backwards here as we're nearing the end, I've just got a few quick fire sort of questions for us to learn a bit more about you. So if your current career wasn't an option and we weren't living in a pandemic, if you could do absolutely anything in the world, what would it be?
So my second preference when I was doing my preferences for university was to do science and engineering. So my grandfather on my father's side was the Surgeon General for the Navy, but my grandfather on my mother's side was a scientist. He worked with Sir Alan Walsh in developing the atomic absorption spectrophotometer, which is a hell of a mouthful. It's a scientific instrument that's used pretty much in every laboratory every day. It measures the atomic weight of stuff using the absorption of light. I always had a science background, and I was a bit of a tech nerd throughout university, so often created websites for our cohort and shared materials and stuff like that all the way through med school. So I think if I hadn't have done medicine, I probably would have ended up in a paramedical kind of technology field, probably, you know, in engineering, you know, developing equipment or scientific equipment and things like that. I still find the things that we can do with technology quite incredible, and modern pacemakers work, you know, the way we can get readings of so much data from humans now. It's really cool. So I would have loved to have been on the forefront of that, developing new medical technologies.
Thanks, Brad. When you were saying before that you've learnt more from the bad bosses that you had than the good ones, is there any advice that you'd give a former boss or someone that you've worked with if you could see them again?
Definitely. The one I would have given to the surgeon that had the temper tantrums was, tantrums should finish by the time you're age 4. Perhaps you should see a paediatrician, which probably wouldn't have gone down all that well. And the other thing I would have given to most of the bosses, but I actually gave a lot of them a hard time about this because I was in the luxurious position of, in my intern and resident years, of not needing references, because I was always going into the military and I was accepted into the general practice training program. So my big advice, and I said this to them, is pay overtime because why should you have to work for free? How is the hospital ever going to know how much work is being done in this hospital and how much stress you're putting on junior doctors, making them stay doing 6 hours of unpaid overtime if it's not recorded? Hospital admin will be like, we're a highly efficient hospital. It's like, no, you're not, because just your staff are working for free. Yeah, I pulled them up about it. One of the consultants actually put my discharge summaries on his desk and said, I'm leaving now. He's like, no, you're not, you've got to finish these. I'm like, well, okay, here's my overtime sheets. You can't do that. Blah, blah, blah. Like, yeah, no, I can. And I will. You'll never get a reference. I don't care. I don't really need a reference from you. He always signed off my overtime after that.
That sounds like a pretty good lesson. I'm sure a lot of people listening will have had a similar experience to you, and we'll hope that they're in a similar position as you so that they can do the exact same.
But this is the thing that annoys me. It shouldn't be that. It shouldn't be that a fear of reprisal doesn't lead to systematic change. And one of the things I was actually most surprised about was when I pulled up a radiology registrar as a resident. So this guy was notorious for just being an a-hole for no apparent reason, really. And so all the residents were fearful of going down there with their CT requests and going, oh, will you please sign off on my CT? Why do you need it? What do you need it for? What on earth are you hoping for? You'll never get into do anything in medicine with this advantage. You call that a handover. That's ridiculous. Oh, right. And so one day I just went in there and I was just like, do you realize you're an asshole? And he was like, what? What? I'm like, look, I'm trying to do a job here. I'm not trying to be difficult. This is what the consultant wants. He wants a CT abdo for this patient with abdominal pain post-op. They think it's legitimate. in some respects, like, why are you giving me a hard time about this? Like, well, I'm trying to educate you. This isn't an effective way to teach junior doctors. Maybe just try being nice and just say, hey, maybe next time you could do this. And then one of the consultants kind of overheard this conversation and kind of wandered over and said, what's going on? I said, that's an asshole. And amazingly, it generated behavior change. So the radiology registrar after that point, he was still an a-hole. I'm going to be honest about it, but he was less of an a-hole than he was previously. So sometimes, you know, you don't have to have a fear of reprisal. I think if you go in with a positive attitude to people and just kind of with a smile and pull people up on things, they'll often respond better than you think they will.
I'm really glad that you got such a positive response after you stuck your neck out. This is probably the last question we have time for, so it's a bit of a tricky one. Can you think of a time when you failed at something, and what did it teach you?
Oh, that is a tricky one. So, I mean, I have a failure every single night in my household of getting my daughter to eat a vegetable. And the lesson I've taken from that is 3.5-year-olds are sociopaths. Yeah, I think the failures you remember in medicine are the misdiagnoses. So I had one recently, which was a sort of middle-aged guy who presented with, he'd had a trauma to the testicles. He had a lot of bruising and injuries and things and kind of having an intermittent ache. And I examined the testicle. I couldn't feel anything that felt out of sorts. You know, I just said, look, I think everything's okay. But I didn't think there was anything sinister going on. And then I actually look after his mum, and his mum told me that a week or two later, he was still having a bit of pain. So I went and saw another doctor who ordered an ultrasound, and actually they found a testicular cancer in there. So every time, I guess, moments like that happen where you miss something, you do something, you review your process. I think the biggest tip I can give people when it comes to your failures in medicine is to never review the emotion or the outcome. Review the process. This is what they do in aviation. So I'm also a pilot. I've got my private pilot's license, and it's in aviation medicine and things along the way as well. In aviation, it's all about process. Everything is done on a checklist. And when aviation disasters happen, they never just look at, oh, Jesus, pilot error, what an idiot. How did that pilot error come about? What was the system that was in place that led to that pilot error ever being able to happen in the first place? So that's what I try to do with my errors in medicine. And I think there's a lot we can learn from the aviation industry in medicine. You know, the nursing checklists came from aviation, that in theatre, doing the checkoff of making sure everything has been accounted for. You know, that's an aviation industry standard. So when it comes to the failures, I look back at, what did I miss? What could I have done differently? Was I aware of the latest guidelines in terms of screening for testicular cancer? Reflecting on that as a personal weakness, just reflecting on that as, yeah, did I have that knowledge at the time? Was I overconfident? Was there ego involved, thinking that I was overly reassuring of the patient? So take it right back to the level of every kind of decision and looking at the processes of those decisions rather than the outcomes of those decisions. And then that makes you improve as a clinician. That's how you adapt your processes over time. And that's also how you learn to live with them. Because living with your mistakes is one of the hardest things that we do, particularly if someone dies. And we have to be able to separate that in our mind, because it can destroy you as a person if you're not careful. And I've seen that happen to doctors where there's been a disastrous outcome. They've taken it so hard and taken it so personally that they can't continue in their career in medicine, or they can't, or it's drastically changed their practice in a way that has become unhealthy or unproductive. You see doctors who miss a diagnosis of breast cancer who suddenly now start ordering mammograms in everyone, you know, age 20 and above, because they're so paranoid about missing another one. But if you reviewed it more nuanced and more detailed in a more structured and regimented way, then you would be able to adapt your practice in a much more healthy way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I agree. When something bad happens, it is really hard not to sort of order tests on everyone and to really cover your butt. I think that the advice to review the processes is really good.
Yeah, exactly. And there will be times when adverse outcomes happen to patients and you would have done nothing differently and they just missed. You know, I had a patient last year who, she's recently just passed away from metastatic sarcoma, and, you know, she'd had this kind of chronic back pain for 20 plus years, and then had an acute on chronic kind of back pain, quite unrelenting, you know, a bit different to a previous one. You know, I ordered a scan and it came back as clear. There was no signs of any problems in the spine. I was like, oh, okay, it must just be a complete different strain, a muscular strain, you know. And then 6 months later, she ends up in hospital, has another scan. They find huge sarcoma, metastatic, spread all throughout her abdomen. So was that there early on in the radiologist missed it? Well, I asked the radiologist and they said, no. Should I have done another scan 3 months later? No, probably not, because there was an early scan there. And it really was, she just had an incredibly aggressive tumour that came up very, very quickly. And I could not have done anything differently. But I still reviewed my processes and still kind of looked back at, had I done anything? Had I missed this? Had I not missed it? It's important to do that. And the other thing that's good to do when it comes to reviewing your failures is to review your successes. And we don't do that enough. We don't look at things that work well and understand why they work well. If you have a really good consult or you have a really good outcome for a patient, what was it that made that good? How can I bring that to other patients? How can I bring that to my everyday? And I did that self-reflection kind of not that long ago when it came to my trauma patients and things like that. And I realized that the things that made those consults good was when I shared and when I was open up with them and that build rapport and that developed the relationship, and that's something I brought to other consults, and then it's adapted my practice as well from there. Don't just review your failures.
Thank you very much, Brad, for joining me for this episode. That's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening to today's episode of the AMSA Ampule Podcast M2.0 series. Our code word this week is brunch, which you can enter into our portal on the website www.m2020.com.au to go into the running for some great prizes and giveaways. And over the course of our series, you will be able to collect one image per week for our M20 sticker book. The M2.0 series is a subset of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Student Association's ongoing podcast series. The M2.0 series highlights speakers who would have presented at our 2020 AMSA National Convention. If you would like to learn more about our podcast, you can visit our website www.m2020.com.au or our parent website www.amsa.org.au. Or if you prefer, we are on social media as AMSA National Convention on Facebook and Instagram. For more information on topics covered in this podcast, you can reach out to AMSA on Facebook and Instagram or via the AMSA website. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the speakers and do not definitively represent those of AMSA or their subsidiaries. If you would like to know more about our public policies, please visit our website at www.amsa.org.au and select Advocacy followed by Official Policy. This episode of AMPUL was hosted and edited by Caitlin Smart, with special guest Dr. Bradley Frew, and music by James Palmier and credits by Nick Barrett.